You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
you gonna do?
Do you really think that?
Do you think it all?
Yeah. I never meant cares about
ain't
you.
Ain't giving up a second thought about you. No. Ghetto people.
Who you gonna turn to next?
Tell me.
People.
You gotta take a look at yourself. Yeah. Ghetto people. With your life
running like a red disease,
running like a red disease. Ghetto people,
stop giving up yourself.
Stop doing what you're doing to yourself, yo. You got to learn to love yourself. Yeah. Ghetto people.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe. Civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement: Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted. And we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashay. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi, Hotep family. Hope everything is well for you today. Hope you're going to have a good day. Of course, it's a great day. It's El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, Brother Omowale, Malcolm X's birthday. It's a great day. We're not going to have the usual things that we do. The announcements and the lineup. I'm going to go directly to the Enye Sesim, read from that, and then directly to talking about Malcolm X's birthday. On another note, a side note, unfortunate note, the comedian Paul Mooney has passed. Comedian Paul Mooney has passed from a heart attack. He was 79 years old. And just want to say briefly, I had opportunity to, he was going to be in Milwaukee. I was on the radio. I was on the radio on Fridays. It was a Friday evening that was going to be on in Milwaukee. And he was on the radio, and I was on the radio program with him. And in one of the breaks, I just made mention that I said, this stuff ain't funny, is it? This shit ain't funny, is it? You know, him being a comedian. And he said, no, it's not. What these folks have done to us is not funny. It's tragic. And what they continue to do to us. So, may they be pleased with Brother Paul Mooney, who passed away, I believe, last night of a heart attack at 79 years old. But today is Malcolm X's birthday. So the first half of this program, we're going to talk about his impact on our lives. And in the second half of the program, we're going to speak with Chief Igumawale of Tulsa, Oklahoma, who's one of the grassroots tour guides to the Greenwood, Archer, and Pine District, or better known as Black Wall Street in Tulsa. Once again, next week, Thursday, I'll be leaving for Tulsa, so I won't be broadcasting next week, Friday, but I'll be going to Tulsa to participate in the commemoration of the 100th year of the massacre that Europeans have once again done to us. So, to get off into the Enye Sesim, I see a number of people have already called in. And of course, if you want to be a part of this conversation, just let me know. And you know, those who are on in the queue, just hit star twice and you can be in, or just continue to dial 215-490-9832, 215-490-9832. May 18th. The word protest is a mask for inaction. The deepest strain in establishment protest is sterile and socially irrelevant. Endless debate, political petitions, the sending of telegrams and letters, the whole ritual of mimeography, machines, and typewriters, mimeographs. All this has been a substitute for hard analysis and risky action. The word risk. This separates the establishment and its perennial critics, the radicals. Lerone Bennett,
Jr. before the Mayflower, Lerone Bennett. Protests by their victims over issues of genocide does not bother Irugu in the slightest, as long as the way we think about praise and due protest still prioritizes their safety, welfare, and feelings as the most important aspects of our tactics and solutions, and keeps them squarely at the center of our existence and possibilities. Any disagreement or empathy they express about it is merely for show. They know that in their reality, there and our situation will remain relatively unchanged no matter the level of protest or the forms it takes. In the meantime, as we plan out loud, they stand by, looking down, waiting to efficiently and beneficially direct the quarreling of predictable, minor, meaningless rebellions. And if necessary, they will absorb or make paper martyrs, martyrs whose beliefs and behaviors are not progressively advanced by those saying that they honor them as martyrs, out of the personalities involved. By far, though, their most successful enduring strategy for defusing both rebellion and revolution is deception. They have effectively confused the difference between themselves and those who would rebel or revolt against them by making it seem that we are one and that everywhere, whatever harm we may experience at their hands is for the benefit of all of us. Affirm, I engage in hard analysis and risky analysis, productive action. Affirm, I engage in hard analysis and risky, productive action. May 19th, when Africans speak of the ancestor, they do not speak of all the dead in the family, clan, and nation. They speak more specifically of those whose lives were examples to their descendants, those who were paragons of moral virtue and had valorous lives on the battlefield or made some significant contributions to the ongoing life of their descendants. They are the root of the culture, the guardians of our tradition. Leonard Barrett. Negroes can never be warrior ancestors. They are the dead to be forgotten, except as reminders of what not to become. Their treason is unforgettable and in most cases unforgivable. An elder, now ancestor, in our community gives us a shining example of what our response to them should be whenever and wherever we have gathered in solemn communion with our ancestors. While pouring libation for us, he also took a moment to pour for them, the treasonous, but instead of pouring their libation in fertile ground of the space we had gathered together in as he did for us, he would go outside to spit the portion of the liquid he had reserved for them on the dead concrete to welcome them away. Negroes must be dismissed and distanced as we do any other contagion. Affirm, as we elders and olders, I distinguish my ancestors from those who merely died. Affirm, as with elders and olders, I distinguish my ancestors from those who merely died. The Enye Sesim of Daily Revolutionary Thought for Warriors. Yes, my brother, we're going to talk about the birth date of a man who I think for many of us who think in this way, who think of independence, who think of self-determination, who think of liberation, who think of sovereignty for African people, who are Pan-Africanists, we embraced Malik El-Shabazz, Brother Omar Wally, Brother Malcolm X. We embrace him because he was our manhood. As Ozzie Davis said in his eulogy, our prince, our shining black prince. And if anybody deserves to be talked about in such reverence, to me, it's him. It is him. I few pieces I'm going to play. Also, I'm going to talk about Omaha, Nebraska, his birthplace, the fact that he was born in Omaha, left Omaha early in his life, his family, Earl Little and his mother, Louise Little, left Omaha and came to Milwaukee. That's right. They moved to Milwaukee. If anybody's familiar with Milwaukee, there's a school, Seaford School, on Galena Street, on like 13th and Galena. He lived in that area of Galena Street. In fact, today there's an expressway that goes through there, as all communities, black communities, an expressway that goes through there, you know. Here's some venues of Brother Malcolm. I hope that you understand and enjoy them. Thought this thing was going to play. Oh.
Outside the courtroom, I asked Malcolm X, giving his first television interview, whether the black Muslim prophet is preaching race hatred.
He's not teaching hate, he's teaching history. And since the American white man has used his control over the press and over the textbooks and over all forms of media to make it appear that he has done us a favor by bringing us here and enslaving us, then the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has to rewrite history or retell history. And since the white man can't dispute this truth, he tries to defend himself by saying that Mr. Muhammad is teaching hate. It's not hate to say that we were kidnapped and brought here. It's truth. It's not hate to say that we were Jim Crow, discriminated and segregated. It's truth. It's not hate to say that the Supreme Court, which is the highest court in this country, came up with a hypocritical desegregation decision 9 years ago, which they haven't enforced yet. That's not hate. That's truth.
You're quoted as having said when an airliner crashed with a number of white people on board that you were glad it happened.
The white race in this country collectively are guilty of these crimes that our people are suffering from collectively, and therefore they would suffer some collective disaster, collective grief. And when that plane crashed in France with 130 white people on it, and we learned that 120 of them were from the state of Georgia, the state that my own grandfathers was a slave in, why, to me, it couldn't have been anything but an act of God, a blessing from God, and I frankly and sincerely pray for similar blessings from him to repeat themselves as often as he can spare them.
Ashe.
But I take it then you support the freedom-loving attempts of the peaceful marchers in Alabama and these places.
You don't get freedom peacefully. Freedom is never safeguarded peacefully. Anyone who is depriving you of freedom isn't deserving of a peaceful approach by the ones who are being deprived of their freedom. And when black people in this country come out from under the mental straitjacket that the Negro clergymen have placed them in and begin to see that the only way you can get freedom is to get it the same way the white man in this country got it from England, or he says he got it from England. He was willing to pay the price for freedom. When you're willing to pay the price for freedom, then you'll get it. But the Negro in this country has never been willing to pay the price for his freedom. All of the price that we have been paying in the past has been freedom for the white man. We fought abroad so that the white man in America could be free today to sick police dogs on us, to beat our people in the heads with police clubs, and to turn water holes on little women and children and babies simply because they want to walk down the street like decent human beings. Now, the only way you can have peace is to eliminate those injustices, and the American white man is not going to eliminate them. He's going to talk that pretty talk, but he'll still continue to practice those inhuman deeds.
Yes, he will continue to do so, and that's what he has done. And he, believe me, that's what he has done, and he'll continue to do so. And we keep holding out hope that somehow, some way, that...
outside the courtroom...
Let's see. I'm trying to find another one that I love. And I thought I had them queued, but you know, sometimes you go through this and then suddenly the ones you've had that you wanted to play, you know, that ain't there. No, I don't want to play that one either. I don't have that much time. When I'm going to play, I'm hitting it, but it's not allowing me to play it. So I want to talk about, and of course, you're free to join this conversation at 215-490-9832. I want to talk about his time in Omaha, his birthplace, which I have visited many times. I have a dear friend that lives in Omaha. And in fact, every time I come to Omaha, I make a pilgrimage to his birthplace. And when I was coming, one of the first times I came to Omaha as a firefighter for the firefighters conference, you know, I stated to our brothers and sisters that those who wanted to go, we should make a pilgrimage to his birthplace. And at that time, it was very hard because there were some homes that were dilapidated around there. There was a Jehovah Witness building and a lot of shrubbery, a lot of foliage. And the marker, you had to go into it, into all the foliage to find the marker. And unfortunately, that it had rained previous. So, but to me, I didn't give a damn if it was knee deep. I'm paying homage. And we poured libation. There's probably about 15 of us, I think, who went out of the maybe close to 100 of us that was there, you know. But we poured libation and so forth. And I've done that a couple of times going to Nebraska until the city of Omaha, Nebraska, allocated money and funds were raised to create the Malcolm X Center and make it something that everybody would be, you know, respectful of, you know. And I'm quite sure one of the people who were instrumental in helping was State Senator Ernie Chambers. If you ain't hip to State Senator Ernie Chambers of Nebraska, who Omaha is his district, you need to be. He is to me an example of what a legislator should be about, whether it's a local legislator, state or federal. He is for our people. You know, in fact, he didn't wear suit and ties. He wore dashikis and sweatshirts and so forth and T-shirts with sayings. one of my honors in Omaha one time, well, I was there for the black police officers. I was on a panel and shared the stage with Brother Ernie Chambers. Had a chance to talk to him at some length, you know. But I gave a presentation at the center, about almost 7 years ago, because I think I was living in Milwaukee, about to move here to Atlanta, and gave a presentation on a Saturday afternoon at the center located at 3448 Evans and Pinckney, the Malcolm X Memorial Foundation Center. And I'm looking at some photos, you know, as they cleaned it up. There's the marker that they had there. Brother Ernie Chambers, just a dynamic brother. He said, Malcolm X was a man of rare commodity. I've always admired him. Same here, dear brother. Sitting there with a picture between Malcolm and Frederick Douglass. And, of course, this street named after Malcolm X Avenue. And the site that they're going to... And then there's daughter his oldest daughter, Attila, you know, he had six daughters. He had a set of twins, six daughters. And Attila Shabazz, I think she lives in L.A. I did meet her, and she was our speaker at the L.A. convention that we had in early 2000, I think like it's 2004. And just a strong woman, beautiful woman. I think that of all her sisters, she somebody to be truly admired for her beauty and strength. Sister Attila Shabazz kind of takes after her mother. And then there was a sister in Omaha, Miss Rowena Moore. And she founded the Malcolm X Memorial Foundation in 1971. You know, and she opposed discrimination in the meatpacking plants. And she was a labor leader and finally got jobs and equal pay for brothers and sisters, particularly sisters in Omaha. And in fact, she lived, whose family once lived in the same house as Malcolm's family at 3448 Pinckney Street. And so she was one instrumental, elderly sister, instrumental in helping to put that together. And they show some photos of Malcolm X days in Omaha, Nebraska, and the site where the center is going to be built. And that was later on. And even though they show some pictures, the earlier pictures, that site wasn't built until like about less than 10 years ago. Yeah. So, yeah. Malcolm X. Yeah, he lived in Milwaukee for a hot minute. Yeah. 414-507, 414-507. Good afternoon. Oh, good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Brother Oshie.
Hey, Brother LaRue. Hey, Ed, how you doing?
I'm doing good, sir. I'm doing good. I'm glad you mentioned Rowena Moore, man. And Matthew Stelly, man, he played a... we was there, man, when it was... like when you said it was a lot of foliage there.
Yeah, yeah.
We had a little thing, man, where we went to help go clean it out. They had a little campaign to go clear out a lot of that foliage, man.
Yeah.
But yeah, but Rowena Moore, man, she was a spearhead in that one.
Yeah, but, it's beautiful.
Let me tell you my little story about Malcolm, man. Now, I'm born in Omaha, Nebraska, right? Okay. So I had a chance to go to college through a wrestling scholarship.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So I had heard about Malcolm, you know? But but the thing about it, is that I did not even know Malcolm X was born in Omaha, Nebraska until I went to college. This was like in 69. And that's when they came out, Alex Haley came out with the autobiography of Malcolm X. And, hey man, I was shocked. I'm like, Malcolm X was born in Omaha, Nebraska? And I'm in college before I learned this, man.
Wow.
And that's when I realized that my education that I was getting,
right.
Near you, huh?
Right. No, go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead and say it.
That's when I realized that the education that I had received, and I never learned about Malcolm X. I knew it was bogus.
Well, yeah, because I mean, it's just like my next guest, Brother Chief Ogumawale, out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. You know, once the situation had happened, they suppressed it. To the extent it was never talked about, and even amongst our people, they didn't talk about it out of fear of what kind of reprisal that might happen. So for two generations, at least three maybe, because that's 60 years, you know, they didn't talk about it. So many people did not know about the massacre, and that's what could happen. And it's the same happened with you, you know?
Exactly, man. So anyway... So, man, when I started reading that autobiography of Malcolm X, man, I stopped going to my – I think I went to one class. That was a philosophy class. I liked that one. And, man, I was a slow reader, man. And it took me almost a whole week, maybe 2 weeks, to go through to read the whole book. I didn't put it down until I finished, man. But that was the thing about Malcolm X, man, that really it really got me, man. I loved it, that autobiography of Malcolm X.
Yeah.
And the Memorial Center, people can Google it now. that there is a memorial center there in Omaha, the Malcolm X Memorial Center in Omaha, Nebraska.
Yeah.
And it is,
No, yeah, I spoke there about 7 years ago, did a presentation there, and I'm truly honored to do so. And just like you, when I first went there, you had to go and step in all this foliage and so forth. And there was a Jehovah Witness church there, right? And that's that Jehovah Witness church is really the foundation of the Memorial Center, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Man. So anyway, that's my little thing about Malcolm X, man. And I can't think of anything else I wanted to say about him, but he was my first hero, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
And the way that he uses logic to make his point, I learned from that. So his logic, man, was so cold. And Ernie Chambers, man, his logic is just as cold as Malcolm X.
Yes, Ernie Chambers,
no
brother.
Doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt. But man, he's dying a slow death, man, there in Omaha, Nebraska. You would think that the level of consciousness would be higher than it is.
Yeah.
But man, he was like a flower in the middle of the desert, man. Yeah.
Well, three things aside from the memorial. The bookstore, is the bookstore still open? Do you know?
No, it's not open, man. Mr. Taylor, he passed away about about 6-7 months ago, I think.
Oh, wow.
And Mr. Taylor, he was instrumental in establishing that memorial center.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so his wife kind of took it over for a while, but I don't think she could handle it or something. But as far as I know, it's not open.
Jeez.
So that's another bookstore that we lost.
Yeah. I enjoyed that.
After Reading Choice.
Yeah. Man.
Yeah.
Like I said, I've been to Omaha many times, and in fact, I even had a presentation at the bookstore. And, man, that's really tough. I didn't know that. So you have Ernie Chambers. You have the bookstore. You know, and so is Ernie Chambers still part of the state Senate? Do you know?
Yeah, as far as I know, he is.
Okay.
But, man, over time, man, I think they just kind of wore him down, man. I mean, he didn't get the support I think that he should have gotten.
Oh, there's no doubt. He should have been the leader within that because he was fighting for our people, you know.
He was definitely fighting
for our people. He minced no words. And he was, to me, he was a model of what a legislator should be about. You know, he didn't come there to make friends. He didn't come there to placate. He didn't come there to He came there to do the business of make sure his constituents, which is our people, period, maybe not just even his district, you know, that we got what we deserve in terms of you know, monies and programs and so forth, man. That's tough. But then that's understandable.
There is really no more black community per se like it used to be anyway in Omaha, man. They broke that up. They tore down the project. And so the level of consciousness has even been more divided. When they took out the project, they took away the economic base for the Lake Street area, from 24 from Ames to Cummings to Ames, and so man, there's very few businesses that are doing anything there. Especially that was the hub it was like Black Wall Street, man, in Omaha.
Yeah,
24th Street was. But anyway, that's all been all broke up.
Yeah,
and it's really kind of it's heartbreaking to me, man, to when I go visit Omaha.
Yeah, I know, bro. Yeah. I know. That would be a hard spot for myself, man, realizing, you know, gosh, what could have been and should have been.
Right.
I know that I'm going to be on a panel discussion on the 25th. That's African Liberation Day. And the theme is What's in a Name. And I know for you, that's real important. And I'm going to be making mention about not using particular words. And of course, to call ourselves and call our ancestors slaves is definitely one of them. So that's going to be on the 25th. So I may make mention of the details today, but no doubt on Friday. Friday, my guest will be Renoka Rashidi, but I'm going to make sure I get that in because I want to make sure that y'all know about the program on African Liberation Day. There's four entities, the New York chapter of the Pan-African Federalist Movement, Atlanta, D.C., and there's another one, Atlanta, D.C., Memory. I tell you, I ain't lying, LaRue. I gotta take some ginkgo biloba or something, man. But yeah.
You're all right, man. You're all right. Nobody remembers everything, man. Yeah. I mean, I don't care how old you are or how young you are, man. Some things just ain't going to come to your mind right away, but it will.
It will. It does. Yeah. Let me play this one, Brother LaRue, and you just hang in there, man, okay?
Okay, sir. And, man, now.
I'm sorry, LaRue, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, man, back to Malcolm. He was my first hero, man, and I learned how to use logic by listening to him, and I think we all can, man.
No doubt, my
brother. You know what? And I think that today, man, there are a lot of our young people who still don't know a lot or don't know much about Malcolm X at all.
No, because number one, what they do, they get a sanitized version of all of our history. It's just a blurb. You know, just a little bit brief thing. You're not going into any depth or anything. You're not going to get the logic. You're not going to hear the words, you know, which is totally unfortunate, you know. But here's another piece that I like by Malcolm. Yeah.
In order for you and me to devise some kind of method or strategy to offset some of the events or a repetition of the events that have taken place here in Los Angeles recently, we have to go to the root. We have to go to the cause. Dealing with the condition itself is not enough. And it is because of our effort toward getting straight to the root that people oftentimes think we're dealing in hate. We are oppressed. We are exploited. We are downtrodden. We are denied not only civil rights, but even human rights. So the only way we're going to get some of this oppression and exploitation away from us or aside from us is come together against a common enemy. Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you? And I, for one, as a Muslim, believe that the white man is intelligent enough. If he were made to realize how black people really feel, and how fed up we are without that old compromising sweet talk. Stop sweet talking it. Tell him how you feel. Tell him how, what kind of hell you've been catching, and let him know that if he's not ready to clean his house up, if he's not ready to clean his house up, he shouldn't have a house. It should catch on fire and burn down.
Yep, I like that speech. There are many others, but I like that one. I mean, you know, Malcolm is just dynamic. He was not a civil rights. He didn't care about civil rights. He cared about human rights. He didn't care if we can sit on the same toilet seat that Caucasians sat on. Didn't care whether we can go to the movie house and sit next to them. He didn't care about none of it. He cared about the human rights of his as a human being. No. I'm going to do some quotes that Malcolm had. In fact, some of the quotes that he has are just dynamic, aren't they? You know, he says, education is our passport to the future, for tomorrow belongs to those who prepare for it today. A lot of times when you hear a quote, sometimes you need to break it down to understand, you know, what is really being expressed and conveyed. Because he wasn't talking about the education, you know, that we received in the public schools. Because he sure hell wasn't talking about that, you know. He wasn't talking about that. He was talking about the kind of education for liberation, the kind of education for self-determination, the education that lets you know who you are and what you're about. That's what he was talking about. Because if we're going to get up out of this madness, we need education. But we need the right kind of education. Sometimes I tell you, okay, here we go. To be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts their hands on you, send them to the cemetery. Because see, he believed in, he wasn't a violent man. But if you are violent, you will meet violence with violence. If you want to speak on this issue, if you're in the queue, hit star twice, and you can join this conversation. We got about 10 minutes left in the conversation before we take a break, and then hopefully our guest. And if not, man, we'll just continue on. You know how flexible we can be, you know. Nobody can give you freedom. Nobody can give you equality or justice or anything. If you're a man, you take it. See, that's the thing about Malcolm in his quotes. He was like, bump that. Quit begging. Quit crying. Quit hoping. Take it. Man, take it. I'm going to end with the eulogy and a theme for Malcolm by Donald Byrd and the Blackbirds. The eulogy that was given by Ozzie Davis. The eulogy that you heard in the film, Spike Lee's edition of Malcolm X.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie. On Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Here, at this final hour, in this quiet place, Harlem has come to bid farewell to one of its brightest hopes, extinguished now and gone from us forever. It is not in the memory of man that this beleaguered, unfortunate, but nonetheless proud community has found a braver, more gallant young champion than this Afro-American who lies before us, unconquered still. I say the word again as he would want me to, Afro-American. Afro-American Malcolm. Malcolm had stopped being Negro years ago. It had become too small, too puny, too weak a word for him. Malcolm was bigger than that. Malcolm had become an Afro-American, and he wanted so desperately that we, that all his people, would become Afro-Americans too. There are those who still consider it their duty, as friends of the Negro people, to tell us to revile him, to flee even from the presence of his memory, to save ourselves by writing him out of the history of our turbulent times. And we will smile. They will say that he is of hate, a fanatic, a racist, who can only bring evil to the cause for which you struggle. And we will answer and say unto them, did you ever talk to Brother Malcolm? Did you ever touch him or have him smile at you? Did you ever really listen to him? Was he ever himself associated with violence or any public disturbance? For if you did, you would know him. And if you knew him, you would know why we must honor him. Malcolm was our manhood, our living black manhood. This was his meaning to his people. And in honoring him, we honor the best in ourselves. However much we may have differed with him or with each other about him and his value as a man, let his going from us serve only to bring us together now. Consigning these mortal remains to earth, the common mother of all. Secure in the knowledge that what we place in the ground is no more now a man, but a seed, which after the winter of our discontent will come forth again to meet us, and we shall know him then for what he was and is, a prince, our own black shining prince, who didn't hesitate to die because he loved us so.
And so today, May 19th, we celebrate Malcolm X's birthday because he was a great, great Afro-American. And Malcolm X is you, all of you. And you are Malcolm X.
I'm Malcolm X!
I'm Malcolm X!
I'm Malcolm X!
I'm Malcolm X!
I'm Malcolm X.
I am Malcolm X.
I am Malcolm X.
I am Malcolm X.
I am Malcolm X.
Has Brother Malcolm served? We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be given the rights of a human being, to be respected as a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. Donald Byrd and the Blackbirds, a theme from Malcolm, and of course, the eulogy that was done by Ozzie Davis. I mentioned African Liberation Day, which is next week, Tuesday. May 25th is African Liberation Day. And to me, whatever you're going to do, that's not the weekend before, the weekend after. No, on that day, just like for the Caucasians, July 4th is July 4th. May 25th is May 25th. That's African Liberation Day. And we'll have a whole thing on it on Monday, because that is the day before, and we'll talk about that on May 25th. So the town hall meeting is Florida, D.C., Atlanta, and New York. Those four communities are presenting this town hall meeting. What's in a name? It's a virtual town hall meeting, forging a common African identity. And that's going to be 6 p.m. to 8:30. 6 p.m. to 8:30 on Tuesday, May 25th, African Liberation Day. And it's a Zoom link, and I'll provide that, and I don't know if there's a better way, but it's hosted by the North American Pan-African Federalist Movement. North American, if you are in the Atlanta area, you can contact our dear sister, Mama Nabantu, at 650-766-5663, 650. If you're in the Florida area, Mama Ayeka Awako, I believe it's pronounced, is 352-485-2079. And the D.C., Brother Sam, in the D.C. area, Brother Sam, at 202-306-6294. I don't have the New York contact, but once again, before that time comes, and I'll have Mama Nabantu. In fact,
Let me get Mama Nabantu on right now. Good afternoon, Mama Nabantu. How are you?
I'm wonderful, wonderful. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Okay. I just want to make some comments about Malcolm X.
Sure.
And also with the Pan-African Fellows Movement.
Yes.
By state. We have, from here, we have yourself as a speaker. We have Auntie as a speaker, who are also a member of the Pan-African Fellows Movement here. And then I reached out to Attorney Nkechi Taiba, and she'll be there.
Okay.
And because she's out of D.C., she'll be representing D.C.
Okay.
So I just want to say that I don't know the names of the other speakers from Florida and what was the other?
Okay. But, I mean, I know by that time we'll have more details, but I appreciate the opportunity to present. You know, and I'm looking forward to listening to all the others, especially my sister. She's dynamic. I've been on a number of programs with her before.
Right.
Kwanzaa.
Yeah.
She's here for Kwanzaa. Yeah. And I think, was it Pan-African Federalist Movement or ASCAC? One of those that had a Zoom, you know. Sometimes you be in all these Zoom meetings, you can't remember which one was which.
She was with us on the convention.
Yeah.
When we had the convention back.
Okay.
October.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I also wanted to comment with regard to Malcolm. My uncle was the Earl Grant was a lieutenant for Malcolm X, and over the years he sent me many videos that probably a lot of folks have not seen, and one of them that he sent me was about who was behind the funding of Elijah Muhammad and also the KKK. He said the same person that was funding them was also funding the KKK, and that when he said the chickens have come home and roost, that's what got Elijah Muhammad upset, because he was afraid of losing funding. So I do have a video that explains that.
So when Malcolm said, When the reporter said to him, you know, that the deaths of some Caucasians were chickens coming home to roost, and of course that was the impetus behind Elijah Muhammad silencing Malcolm, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So that meant the funding might be cut.
Okay. And so they were getting funding from some outside source, you know.
From a white guy.
Yeah. And you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the European Jews, like the, you know, European Jews that finance both sides of the Civil War, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They finance both sides of it, because in that way, you know, even though they lost money on one end, but they're going to gain bigger money on the other end, you know.
Right.
That was the Rothschilds and a number of European Jewish family. The Rothschild.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
The other impetus behind that was to keep the KKK and the Islamic folks from getting into a race riot.
Okay.
So this guy felt that he was able to keep them comfortable by funding them to keep them apart. I mean, that was some of the things that Malcolm said in this video.
Mm-hmm.
Also want to say that as a teacher, from school, when I started school just before I started my own school.
Mm-hmm.
I was putting up a poster with Malcolm X picture and phrase "by any means necessary," and the principal told me I had to take it down.
Mm.
I said they can't have that in their school. And then so what I did, I had my children do a play on Malcolm X every single year with the background of living in the city, and they acted out living in the city. Every year,
mm-hmm.
I did back until I left there and started my own school. Even with that, I continued to do that as well. Even if there was another point, the Malcolm X Creed with the Republic of New Africa, I had to memorize that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was 68, 69 when I became an active member. And I'll never forget that Malcolm X creed. In fact, the Harambe's that I do at the end include some of the words from that Malcolm X creed.
Oh, okay.
So, and I also had a chance to travel with one of the twins, Malak Shabazz, in Ghana in 2018. So it's been a life journey learning about Malcolm and trying to not just talk about him or read about him, but to act like him in terms of, you know, what he felt needed to be done as a people, that there's certain things that we always fight no matter what.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, to me, he's the example. He is the model of manhood, the model of peoplehood that we as African people must embrace and follow, you know, because he was uncompromising. He was undead. He was unbought. You know, when you talk about Malcolm, and you remember that when the FBI, after the split happened, the FBI came to his door, and if you remember, he recorded the proceedings to make sure he had a tape recorder under the couch or whatever to make sure that, you know, letting you know that the FBI was there and he was unbought. You know, he would not turn over anything to the FBI, because Malcolm, you know, he understood that when we are at each other, when we're divided, when we're fragmented, they're going to take advantage of us the most. And so therefore, let us show no weakness, let us show no divisions. Even if we have some kind of disagreement, let us put it to the side, because it's petty. It's petty when you consider what the overall objective for us as a people is, and that at this moment and this time is independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty for African people. So we should never compromise on anything.
Right.
You know.
Absolutely.
Yep.
FBI came to my mama's house looking for me and couldn't understand, you know, in school, why would somebody like me be involved with a radical group like the Republic of New Africa? They couldn't understand it. And my father didn't understand that when they showed the picture of me, he said, oh, wait a minute, let me open my watch, show you a good picture of my daughter.
I said, oh, no. Yeah, I hear you. I'm gonna play this piece by Malcolm, and you hang in there, Mama Nabantu. If you got any other questions, you know what to do. All right?
Yes. All right.
All right, dear. Thank you. Yeah, we're going to play another piece. Apparently my guest, Brother Ugumawali, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get him on before I get a chance to go to Omaha. It's Omaha. To go to Tulsa. To get a chance to go to Tulsa. But one thing is for sure, I know that we'll talk to him, you know, after the commemoration of the massacre. The Tulsa massacre is over. So just stand pat. Yeah. We'll just stand pat. What's up with the sound here? Well, brothers and sisters, let me try another one. I apologize.
We have a whole nation of people that can read but don't necessarily understand. And if you want proof for that, just look at any comments on social media about statements that you just read, and you, if you understood them, just read down what people have to say, and you'll realize how illiterate our culture is. He said that he read history. He read Will Durant's Story of Civilization, a multi-volume history of the world. He read H.G. Wells' Outline of History. He read Herodotus. He read Arnold Toynbee. And there was a brilliant library that he said would have been the envy of colleges and universities that had been donated.
What he's talking about, as Malcolm read, he was a voracious reader. Once he remembered how to read, remember, if you know the story of Malcolm, he was an excellent student. He was a very intelligent young man. When he was in middle school in Lansing, he was discouraged when he said he wanted to be an attorney. And the Caucasian told him, you can't be an attorney. Number one, my people definitely wouldn't hire you, and your people wouldn't hire you. Why don't you work with your hands, become a carpenter or something? Turn Malcolm off. And of course, Malcolm wasn't reading anything because he was in the streets. He was hustling. And so he was imprisoned. And it was in prison that he learned that he forgot how to read. And he studied the dictionary by the light in the crack of his cell. He would study the dictionary, study words, and then later he started reading books. And so we'll pick it up from here.
Prison, you can see the divine hand in the education of this man. He said he read philosophy. If you go to Alcatraz and visit Alcatraz, they have a little prison library in there. It's not, the books aren't there anymore, but on the wall it says the inmates were particularly interested in philosophy and would check out Kant and other philosophers. He said he read Kant, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche. He was particularly struck by Spinoza. And one of the things that he said, that he felt that Western civilization had ended up in a cul-de-sac. And I don't think it could be summed up any better than that, the crisis of Western civilization. But he was once asked, he also got into African-American history. He read W.E.B. Du Bois, or Du Bois. And he read his About the Soul of Black Folks, and also read Carter Woodson's Negro History. He read a three-volume book on race and sex and race. He also said that he read Mendel's book on genetics several times, particularly passages from it. And he said the book made clear to him that you could not get a black man from a white man, but you could get a white man from a black man, which substantiated his belief that the first human beings were dark, which, according to our tradition, Adam, Udmat al-Ard, Adam is tawny, it means dark, and Hawa means black. So it wouldn't be at all inconsistent with our understanding of the first people, and we now know that they were probably from South Africa. So we're all Africans, right? Tell that to the crackers. You're a mutation. Melanin deficiency. Some people say that that's part of the problem with the behavior, is it's just a deficiency. And this man was a highly educated man who I would argue that he had a far superior education to many of the PhDs and college graduates. He definitely knew rhetoric. He knew logic. You can clearly see his knowledge of logic is displayed constantly in his argumentation, his pointing out fallacies, logical fallacies. Somebody accused him of being a communist. He said, why would you conclude that? And he said, you spoke at the socialist at some venue of communists in New York. He said, I spoke at Dr. King's church. Does that make me a follower of Dr. King? He said, I spoke last week at the Methodist church. Does that make me a Methodist? Right? This is logic. So when he said, every time I catch a plane, I have with me a book I want to read. Right? And that's a lot of books these days. If I weren't out here every day battling the white man, I could spend the rest of my life reading, just satisfying my curiosity, because you can hardly mention anything I'm not curious about. I don't think anyone got more out of prison than I did. In fact, prison enabled me to study far more intensely than I ever would have if my life had gone differently and I had attended some college. I imagine that one of the biggest troubles, listen up, Zaytuna students, one of the biggest troubles with colleges is there are too many distractions, too much panty raiding, fraternities, and bula bula, and all that. So this man did not get to the Oxford Union, where I spoke at the Oxford Union. When I walked in, they give you a standing ovation just for getting there. You don't even have to give a talk after that. You just wave or something. Because just because you're at the Union, they consider it so prestigious. I mean, this is typical Anglo-Saxon pride. They consider it so prestigious that you've been invited there that you get a standing ovation just for walking in. Right? So he was there December 3rd, 1963, a beautiful speech that he gave on extremism. He went toe-to-toe with professors from Oxford. The ovations in that speech were immense. His diction was impeccable. His elocution is beautiful. He did not speak slang. If he spoke slang, it was for rhetorical effect, which is actually a trope in rhetoric, is to use "we was robbed." That's a rhetorical trope that can be used. So Malcolm knew rhetoric, and he used it to great effectiveness. He was an extraordinary orator, but he was an educated mind. And this is what has to be understood. This man struggled with great difficulty to educate himself. And he spent years, he read, he would read till 3 a.m. in prison. He would read with the light of the hall. And every 58 minutes he would go, because the guard would come by and they weren't allowed to be up at that time, and he would pretend to be asleep. The guard would leave and he would go back and start reading again. This was Malcolm. So when you see this man, you have to understand that this is not something that just came down. All of these gifted people, their great gift is discipline. Their great gift is the ability to struggle against themselves and overcome laziness, overcome the temptations to go the easy way. This is what Malcolm was. He was a highly disciplined individual. He was disciplined morally, he was disciplined intellectually, and he was disciplined spiritually. When his brother Reginald was thrown out, he spent the entire night in prayer. So he was a man of prayer. And these are important things to remember. And finally, in conclusion, it would be difficult to... Malcolm died at 39. It's hard to believe that he was so young when his life was taken away. I mean, that's when the prophets begin, at the age of 40. That's when the intellect really begins to mature and it reaches its real height, you know, during those years. So we don't know what would have happened, and I'm not going to speculate, but one of the last speeches that he gave, and he stopped using black nationalism in that last period because he was struggling with trying to grapple with what the real problem was. And he recognized that there were whites in Algeria that he met, Berbers that are white, that he met, that said they didn't resonate with that word, black nationalism. So he was struggling in himself to find something. But he was asked 1 month before he was killed, "What do you think is responsible for race prejudice in the U.S.?" And Malcolm said, "Ignorance and greed, and a skillfully designed program of miseducation that goes right along with the American system of exploitation and oppression. So it takes education to eliminate it. And just because you have colleges and universities does not mean you have education. The colleges and universities in the American educational system are skillfully used to miseducate." I couldn't put it better.
Would you mind telling me what your father's last name was?
My father didn't know his last name. My father got his last name from his grandfather, and his grandfather got it from his grandfather, who got it from the slave master. The real names of our people were destroyed during slavery.
Was there any line, any point in the genealogy of your family when you did have to use the last name? And if so, what was it?
The last name of my forefathers was taken from them when they were brought to America and made slaves. And then the name of the slave master was given, which we refuse. We reject that name today.
You won't even tell me what your father's supposed last name was or gifted last name was?
I never acknowledge it whatsoever.
Ashe. Yeah. I tell you. Malcolm. Yo. Malik El Shabazz. Unbought.
Who has created the slum and the ghetto that you're living in? Nothing but a debt.
And since the American white man has used his control over the press and over the textbooks and over all forms of media
to make it appear that he has done us a favor by bringing us here and enslaving us, then the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has to rewrite history or retell history. And since the white man can't dispute this truth, he tries to defend himself by saying that Mr. Muhammad is teaching hate. It's not hate to say that we were kidnapped and brought here. It's truth. It's not hate to say that we were Jim Crow, discriminated and segregated. It's truth. It's not hate to say that the Supreme Court, which is the highest court in this country, came up with a hypocritical desegregation decision 9 years ago, which they haven't enforced yet. That's not hate. That's truth.
You're quoted as having said when an airliner crashed with a number of white people on board that you were glad it happened.
The white race in this country collectively are guilty of these crimes that our people are suffering from collectively, and therefore they would suffer some collective disaster, collective grief. And when that plane crashed in France with 130 white people on it, and we learned that 120 of them were from the state of Georgia, the state that my own grandfathers was a slave in, why, to me, it couldn't have been anything but an act of God, a blessing from God, and I frankly and sincerely pray for similar blessings from him to repeat themselves as often as he can spare them.
But I take it then you support the freedom-loving attempts of the peaceful marchers in Alabama and these places.
You don't get freedom peacefully. Freedom is never safeguarded peacefully. Anyone who is depriving you of freedom isn't deserving of a peaceful approach by the ones who are being deprived of their freedom. And when black people in this country come out from under the mental straitjacket that the Negro clergymen have placed them in and begin to see that the only way you can get freedom is to get it the same way the white man in this country got it from England, or he says he got it from England. He was willing to pay the price for freedom. When you're willing to pay the price for freedom, then you get it. But the Negro in this country has never been willing to pay the price for his freedom. All of the price that we have been paying in the past has been freedom for the white man. We fought abroad so that the white man in America could be free today to sick police dogs on us, to beat our people in the heads with police clubs, and to turn water holes on little women and children and babies simply because they want to walk down the street like decent human beings. That's now the only way you can have peace is to eliminate those injustices, and the American white man is not going to eliminate them. He's going to talk that pretty talk, but he'll still continue to practice those inhuman deeds.
You got the Honorable Elijah's message yourself behind prison walls.
When I was a Christian, I committed many crimes, and those crimes led to my own imprisonment, and also led to my being very atheistic, agnostic first and then atheistic. And it was only after hearing the religious teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad that I became religious and was able to reform myself and rehabilitate myself. But I learned that after trying to reform and rehabilitate myself, that the American white man was more against me then than he was when I was a criminal, when I had criminal tendencies and was trying to carry out or practice his Christianity.
Do you blame Christianity for your crimes?
Christianity is one of the real causes of most of the condition that black people in this country are confronted with. It's the religious concept that Christianity has given Negroes in this country that makes us almost incapable of solving our own problems. The black man in this country has a different religious concept when he's a Christian than the white man has. If you notice, the black man is the only one who will turn the other cheek to his enemy, or who will love his enemy, or who will pray for those who despitefully use him, just because he thinks that's what Jesus wants him to do. Now, the white man preaches the same thing, but he doesn't practice it.
Now, this refusal to integrate, surely it must lead to demands for your own state in America.
The black people in this country have been like a misfit wife married to the white man here who hasn't treated us right. And today, since we have given up all hope of him ever changing, we want a divorce. We want a complete separation, but we want a property settlement. And we think that the white man, we think that the American government should give us a property settlement, which means part of this country, which they robbed from the Indians with our help, and which they have worked up to make the kind of land that it is today.
Do you think this really practical? Don't you think that the future really lies with a peaceful transformation of the scene?
If the American government, the Supreme Court, the President of the United States, the Congress and the Senate, and all these white liberals have said that they're for integration, and these Negroes haven't gotten any more integration than they have, well, that's more impractical than separation. Practical means that's what you can practice. And if the Supreme Court and the Army and the Navy and the government and the President are supposed to be for integration and you still can't get it, why, good night. You can't get this impossible. But we can get separation overnight because we already have it.
Mr. Malcolm, thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir. I thank you for letting the people over in Europe know what the white man in this country is doing to black people and the hypocrisy he's practicing when he accuses them over there of not getting their house in order. 20 million black people in this country have been just as thoroughly colonized by the American white man in a more shrewd, modern way than all of the colonized people in Angola, South Africa, or any other part of this world. But the white man over here hides his own dirt by constantly pointing toward Britain and France and Portugal and these other countries and accusing them of being colonial powers when he mastered colonialism before those countries ever knew what it was.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Ashe. Ashe, let the ancestors speak. I'm going to read something to you from Baba Baruti, who posted this, and a tribute to Malcolm, Brother Omawali, Malcolm X, Malik El Shabazz. It's impossible for you and me to have a balanced mind in this society without going into the past, because in this particular society, as we function and fit into it right now, we're such an underdog. We're trampled upon. We looked upon as almost nothing. Now, if we don't get into the past and find out how we got this way, we will think that we were always this way. And if you think you're always in the condition that you're in right now, it is impossible for you to have much confidence in yourself, and you become worthless, almost nothing. But when you go back into the past and find out where you once were, then you will know that you weren't always at this level, that you once had attained a higher level and made great achievements, contributions to society, civilization, science, and so forth. And you know that if you once did it, you can do it again. You automatically get the incentive, the inspiration, and the energy necessary to duplicate what our forefathers formerly did. But by keeping us completely cut off from our past, it's easy for them who has power over us to make us willing to stay at this level, because we will feel that we were always at this level, a low level. And that's one of the problems, of course, that we have. The European has lied. He continues to lie. You see what he did in Kemet. You see how he put his face on it. You see how, that's why I'm saying, and once again, I'm promoting, yeah, the documentary, Great Pyramid K, 2019. Great Pyramid K, 2019. Because to me, it says how they were built and who built them. And they unequivocally, undeniably, they state it was Africans. It wasn't mulattoes. It wasn't no people that are there now. It wasn't no Hyksos or somebody who came into Kemet. It was the Kemetic people themselves. And not only did they do that, but they began to go around the world and do it. African men and women. They said only people that could have worked in that environment were people who had melanated skin. So, on this day, as we reflect on Brother Omawali, Malcolm X, and reflect on what he has done as Africans, I'm going to try to pull another one up that I hopefully that'll play for us. You know, let's see if this will play.
Outside the courtroom, I asked Malcolm X, giving his first television interview, whether the black Muslim prophet is preaching race hatred.
He's not teaching hate, he's teaching history. And since the American white man has used his control over the press and over the textbooks and over all forms of media to make it appear that he has done us a favor by bringing us here and enslaving us, then the Honorable Elijah Muhammad has to rewrite history or retell history. And since the white man can't dispute this truth, he tries to defend himself by saying that Mr. Muhammad is teaching hate. It's not hate to say that we were kidnapped and brought here. It's truth. It's not hate to say that we were Jim Crow, discriminated, and segregated. It's truth. It's not hate to say that the Supreme Court, which is the highest court in this country, came up with a hypocritical desegregation decision 9 years ago, which they haven't enforced yet. That's not hate. That's truth.
You're quoted as having said, when an airliner crashed with a number of white people on board, that you were glad it happened.
The white race in this country collectively are guilty of these crimes that our people are suffering from collectively, and therefore they would suffer some collective disaster, collective grief. And when that plane crashed in France with 130 white people on it, and we learned that 120 of them were from the state of Georgia, the state that my own grandfathers was a slave in, why, to me, it couldn't have been anything but an act of God, a blessing from God, and I frankly and sincerely pray for similar blessings from him to repeat themselves as often as he can spare them.
But I take it then you support the freedom-loving attempts of the peaceful marchers in Alabama and these places.
You don't get freedom peacefully. Freedom is never safeguarded peacefully. Anyone who is depriving you of freedom isn't deserving of a peaceful approach by the ones who are being deprived of their freedom. And when black people in this country come out from under the mental straitjacket that the Negro clergymen have placed them in and begin to see that the only way you can get freedom is to get it the same way the white man in this country got it from England, or he says he got it from England. He was willing to pay the price for freedom. When you're willing to pay the price for freedom, then you'll get it. But the Negro in this country has never been willing to pay the price for his freedom. All of the price that we have been paying in the past has been freedom for the white man. We fought abroad so that the white man in America could be free today to sick police dogs on us, to beat our people in the heads with police clubs, and to turn water holes on little women and children and babies simply because they want to walk down the street like decent human beings. That's now the only way you can have peace is to eliminate those injustices, and the American white man is not going to eliminate them. He's going to talk that pretty talk, but he'll still continue to practice those inhuman deeds.
Thank you. Thank you. I got a little fist and thumbs up from Dr. Rogers. Of course, Dr. Rogers' program every Tuesday.
50 years ago this month that Malcolm X was assassinated.
Dr. William Rogers' Black Reality Think Tank every Tuesday from 8 to 10 here on Time for an Awakening. And, of course, the other programs that we have here. I didn't really go through that because I thought I was going to have my brother Chief Ugumawali, to talk here about the Tulsa. But we're going to finish talking about Malcolm. I'm going to try to pull another one. And, of course, I'm going to give you the rundown very quickly, since Dr. Rogers kind of pulled my coattail. Also, too, for those who are listening, Paul Mooney, the comedian Paul Mooney, passed last night of a heart attack. He was 79 years old. Paul Mooney, one of the great comedic minds. He's a great writer. Once again, this program every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. All times are going to give our Eastern Times. On Mondays from 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds, Public Affairs Programming, out of Philadelphia with Brother Jihad Ahmed. Then that's followed by from 8 to 9, Black Therapy Central with Dr. Mawia Kemban and Nataki Kemban. And then from 9 to 10, Conversations, Reparations every first and third Mondays with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey of In Cobra. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers on Tuesdays. On Wednesdays, Black Farmers Report from 8 to 9 on Wednesdays. This evening, the Black Farmers Report. And then, if it's Friday and it's 8 p.m. Eastern, that's right, brothers and sisters, it's Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Fridays at 8 p.m. Saturdays, Sister Talk will host LaWanda Chambers from 4 to 6. And then from 7 to 9 on Saturdays, the Sankofa Elders Council. And then once again on Sundays, at 7 p.m., it's Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. It's
So that's a quick rundown since Dr. Rogers hit me up. Appreciate you, Dr. Rogers. You know it, my brother. I really do. And I'm going to try to find another piece that we can listen to. And if you want to talk about something that you can just give us a call at 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. And also, too, there's a number of you that are in the queue. And you hit star twice. Hit star twice, and we can engage in some dialogue. Engage in some dialogue. So there's some here I haven't heard, and so I'm not sure, but I'm gonna play.
They don't scare Negroes today with no badge or no white skin or no white sheet or no white anything else. The police the same way. They put their club upside your head and then turn around and accuse you of attacking them. Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of freedom is that? What kind of social or political system is it when a black man has no voice in court, has no nothing on his side other than what the white man chooses to give him? My brothers and sisters, we have to put a stop to this. And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves. They attack the victim. And then the criminal who attacked the victim accuses the victim of attacking him.
Yes, sir.
This is American justice.
Yes, sir.
That's right.
This is American democracy.
Yes, sir.
And those of you who are familiar with it,
yes,
know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy.
Right.
Now, if I'm wrong, put me in jail.
Right.
But if you can't prove that a democracy is not hypocrisy, then don't put your hands on me.
I say, don't put your hands on me. Yeah. The hypocrisy. I think that's the beauty of Malik El Shabazz, Brother Omar Wali. He was unabashed. He was unafraid. He was courageous. He said it like it was. In fact, what was his line? Make it plain. He wanted to tell the people clearly, concisely. He wanted to make sure we all understood. No big words. You know how some brothers have command of the language, so to speak, and in their eloquence, they throw these words out, you know. My thing is always to speak to our people that they understand, they clearly understand what we're up against. And the same thing Malcolm was saying then, we're still saying today. I think one of the problems for us is that because some of us were able to attain some education, some of us were able to get a six-figure job in a position and live in a particular neighborhood and drive a particular car. And so a majority of us believe that that could be me too. Not understanding that no, this is not the hardcore segregationist, the Jim Crow separationist and all that old madness of 60, 70 years ago and prior to our captivity. This is something different. This is the illusion of inclusion, a perception that things are better. But the reality is they are worse. I'm gonna pull something up here.
In this crooked game of power politics here in America, the Negro
namely the race problem, integration, civil rights issue, are all nothing but tools used by the whites who call themselves liberals against another group of whites who call themselves conservatives, either to get into power or to retain power. Among whites here in America, the political teams are no longer divided into Democrats and Republicans. The whites who are now struggling for control of the American political throne are divided into liberal and conservative camps. The white liberals from both parties cross party lines to work together toward the same goal. And white conservatives from both parties do likewise. The white liberal differs from the white conservative only in one way. The liberal is more deceitful, more hypocritical than the conservative. Both want power, but the white liberal is the one who has perfected the art of posing as the Negro's friend and benefactor. And by winning the friendship and support of the Negro, the white liberal is able to use the Negro as a pawn or a weapon in this political football game that is constantly raging between the white liberals and the white conservatives. The American Negro is nothing but a political football, and the white liberals control this ball through tricks or tokenism, false promises of integration and civil rights. In this game of deceiving and using the American Negro, the white liberals have complete cooperation of the Negro civil rights leader, who sell our people out for a few crumbs of token recognition, token gains, token progress. In the New York Tribune, in an editorial dated February the 5th, 1960, they pointed out that out of 11 million qualified Negro voters, only 2,700,000 actually take time to vote. This means that, roughly speaking, only 3 million out of the 11 million Negroes who are qualified to vote take an active part. And the remaining 8 million remain voluntarily inactive. And yet it is this small minority, the 3 million Negro voters, who help determine who will be the next president. If who will be the next president can be influenced by 3 million Negro voters, it is easy to see why the presidential candidates of both political parties put on such a false show with the civil rights bill and promises of integration. They must impress the 3 million voting Negroes who are the actual integration seekers. And if so much fuss is made over these 3 million integration seekers, what would the presidential candidates have to do to appease the 8 million non-voting Negroes if they ever decided to become politically active? They hold the balance of power. Who are the 8 million non-voting Negroes? What do they want? And why don't they vote? The 3 million Negro voters are the so-called middle-class Negroes, or high-class Negroes, or uppity Negroes, who are referred to by the late Howard University sociology professor E. Franklin Frazier as the black bourgeoisie, who have been educated to think as patriotic individualists with no racial pride whatsoever, who believe in and look forward to the future integrated, intermarried society that is constantly being promised to them by the Negro politician. And therefore, this integration-minded 3 million minority remain an active part of the white-controlled political parties. But it must never be overlooked that these 3 million Negro integration seekers are only a small minority of the 11 million qualified Negro voters. The 8 million non-voting Negroes are the majority, the downtrodden black masses. They have refused to vote. They've refused to take a part in politics because they reject the Uncle Tom approach of the clergy politician leadership that has been handpicked for the so-called Negroes by the white man himself. This clergy politician leadership does not speak for the Negro majority. They don't speak for the black masses. They speak for the black bourgeoisie, the brainwashed, white-minded, middle-class minority, who, because they are ashamed of their race, because they are ashamed of being black and don't want to be identified with black, they are seeking to lose this black identity by mixing and mingling and intermarrying and integrating with the white society. The race problem cannot be solved by listening to the white-minded, brainwashed minority. The white man must try to learn what the black majority wants. The president would be wise to try and learn what the black masses want. And the only way to find this out is by listening to the man who speaks for the black masses. And I can declare to you tonight and to the entire world that the man here in America who speaks for the majority, the downtrodden, dissatisfied black masses, is this same man who so many thousands of our people are flocking toward to see and hear. This same Mr. Muhammad, who is labeled by you as a black supremacist and as a racist and as an extremist. If the 3 million middle-class Negroes are casting their ballots for integration and intermarriage, what do the non-voting black masses who are in the majority want? Find out what the black masses want, and then perhaps America's grave race problem can be solved.
And of course, and you know, what's interesting is you hear this and you realize how long ago that was. And then you realize that what he was saying was very prophetic because it hasn't. We have a caller, 646. 646, good afternoon.
Hey, what's happening, Oshi?
Hey, Jay.
You know, it's amazing that all these years later, what Malcolm said is as applicable today as it was yesterday. That just shows you, as a people, we haven't progressed to the level of listening to our elders and our ancestors to be able to deal and address this no good, filthy, stinking white man in the manner in which he should be. It's like, sad to say, some African people are on remote control. And you know, you can't dispute it, because you should never be in your development as a people basically in the same position that you was 50 years ago. You're supposed to have been able, as a collective, evolve into a better people and not be bamboozled and hoodwinked by this white man. And unfortunately, what we don't understand as a people is the white man just getting better and better and better at what he do. And black folks are getting more naive and sucked into his filth each and every day. It's like we can't see the forest from the tree.
Yeah, I hear you, Jay.
All we do is get used by the white man and stay on remote control. And that's why, you know, it's a blessed day to celebrate Malcolm, but it's also really a sad day, because we haven't served the ancestor on the level that we should have, and we haven't listened truly to what he said. Because it ain't no in hell. Let's be very, very clear about this, that a brother should drop that science 60 years ago, and it's still as irrelevant as it is today. Ain't no way in hell you are progressing people to still be in that position.
Yeah.
I don't care what nobody say. That's just a fact.
All right.
And that's a sad tragedy.
Yeah, you're right.
For us as a people to be in that position.
I hear you. 414-507. 414-507. Just hang on, Jay.
Hey, Brother Austin.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, LaRue.
I just wanted to know that last speech that you read. What speech was that?
That was his speech, liberals versus conservatives.
Okay.
Liberals versus
That's all I wanted to know. But, brother, was this on...
Jay?
Jay, brother Jay. He was exactly correct on that, about how applicable that speech is today, man. And they're running these commercials on TV. I mean...
I was searching for something, and I'm glad that somehow I landed on that one, because you're right. And as I was listening to it, I said, yeah, I'm glad I hit on that one. I could have gone somewhere else, but I hit on that one. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good one. I just wanted to know which one that was.
Yep.
All right.
All right, Brother LaRue.
Peace.
We only have a few more minutes. And I want to thank all those who have called in to listen. I apologize. I should have contacted Chief some time ago, I guess, because I just made an assumption that we were going to have this program. But we will. We will talk about the Tulsa massacre and try to get into some of the details in terms of what happened there and what's happening now. He would have been 96 years old. He was born in 1925, he died February 21st, 1965, just a few months before his 40th birthday. And I admired him. I loved Malcolm. I gravitated to Malcolm more than I did Dr. King. I guess that was something in me as a radical. Around that same time, he had already had passed. Because I remember when he passed, I was in the car with my mother, and our cousin from Chicago. We were driving, and on the car radio, they said that Sunday that he had died, that he was assassinated in New York, the Audubon Ballroom. And then, of course, some years later, I learned to box because I loved Muhammad Ali. I don't know if some of you haven't seen One Night in Miami. Our sister, Regina King, put that together. She's the director. And I think you need to see it, although some have misgivings about how Malcolm was portrayed, and to some degree I understand, but I think it's worth the watch. It's not a fact of, they were there, but the proceedings are not a fact. It's for dramatization. But, Malcolm was on a different trajectory. Than the nation. I don't know if some of you have seen the Netflix Who Killed Malcolm X, where a Muslim brother is doing the research and narrating his findings, and at the Newark Mosque, there were members in the Newark Mosque who helped do it, and nothing was ever done. And the guy that did it, who had a sport coat on with a rifle inside, and he walked up to the podium and shot Malcolm, and he walked out. I often said, and I will continue to say, that the Nation of Islam created the atmosphere by which the United States government could have him killed. I don't put that squarely on the Nation of Islam. I don't. Just like Dr. King's death. We are dealing with an evil, evil system. We're dealing with an entity, these Caucasians, that are evil and will do any and everything
to maintain their position of dominance and control. So, brothers and sisters, our time is up once again, and I appreciate those who called, those who are listening, participating. This Friday, my good brother and friend, Baba Rinoko Rashidi, will be my guest. And he has a number of things he's doing. He's got a couple of trips coming up that we'll talk about and so forth. So, brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and sure in the hell don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, you have a blessed and wonderful day. Shemhotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fahodie means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. You have a blessed and wonderful day. Peace, family.